Well, good evening. Welcome to glorious Greenbelt. Let's hope the weather holds up for the bank holiday weekend. My name's June Whitnell. I'm the Home Sales Manager for Hodder & Stoughton Religious Division, and we have just published Philip Yancey's new book, and I'm here to introduce him. So it's great to see so many of you here. Thank you all for coming up to hear Philip. It is a real privilege for me to introduce an author of Philip's calibre. I'm sure that you know him already as one of the top-selling Christian authors today. He's written many books. I'm sure you're familiar with The Jesus I Never Knew, Reaching for the Invisible God, and What's So Amazing About Grace, which today has sold over 750,000 copies worldwide. Could I just ask for a show of hands? How many of you here have read What's So Amazing About Grace? Wow, that is terrific. What a vote of confidence. Philip is currently a freelance writer and editor at large for Christianity Today. He lives with his wife, Janet, who is also here tonight. Janet, I'm sure we'll be talking to some of you later. And they live in Colorado, surrounded by the Rocky Mountains. I'm sure you can imagine that's one of the most beautiful settings for an author to write and to think. And we're here, you're here, to hear what Philip has to say. And as a Christian publisher at Hodders, it's very much our responsibility and our privilege to communicate and to encourage the Christian faith. We do that through various authors. You'll be familiar with people like Jackie Pullinger, who write for us, and Brother Andrew. And they do that through the power of the stories that they have to tell about their involvement, say, in mission or in smuggling Bibles into Far Eastern countries. Philip Yancey, I feel, draws us by the power of his thinking. He really is a guy who takes a lot of time to think about his faith. His writings reach really deep, I think, into our hearts. He has a lot to say to us. So this man who continues to think about and examine his faith often finds answers to his questions in people who really live out their belief and their faith. And that's the subject of his new book. And I very much hope that you'll look for a copy of that on the bookstall. Philip has come to talk to us tonight about stages of faith. So I'm going to hand over to him now, and I hope you'll join me in giving him a really warm welcome.
Gene's right. We live in Colorado, and many would call that the most beautiful state in the United States. 54 of the 60 highest mountains in the country are in Colorado. And right after we moved there, we came from downtown Chicago, and everyone who had ever put on skis in Chicago came to see us. Colorado is a great skiing state. One couple came. They wanted to go skiing all day, and they had some children along, so they brought their Polish nanny to look after the children while we were all skiing. And she was talking to me and said, what do you do? I said, well, I write books. Oh, really? What kind of books do you write? And I said, look, here's a shelf full. I'll show you. And I showed her some. Very interesting. Have you ever had a book that was translated into Polish? I said, I don't know, but here are some foreign editions. Let's look. So I looked for one that had a lot of consonants, C-Z-W type. And I found one. I said, what about this one? Is this Polish? Yes, yes, this is Polish. I said, well, what does it say? She says, it says, disappointment with mold. I don't know Polish. I said, are you sure that's what it says? She said, oh, no, you see, the word for mold is boże, the word for God is boże. It's actually disappointment with God. Felt quite relieved. But I also went back and re-envisioned my books. One of the very first books I wrote was a book on the history of penicillin called Where is Mold When It Hurts? And then the bacilli developed resistance to that disease, to various diseases, so and to the penicillin. So I wrote a sequel called Disappointment with Mold, and later I teamed up with a doctor, and we wrote a book called Fearfully and Wonderfully Mold. And they kept discovering new varieties, so I wrote a book called The Mold I Never Knew, and What's So Amazing About Mold, which many of you have read. And finally, a guide for cleaning your refrigerators called Finding Mold in Unexpected Places. So, but here tonight, I'm not planning to talk about mold as such. I'm planning to talk about stages of faith. One of the things that I have found as a Christian is that we go through various stages, and they're not necessarily in the same order that you would expect at all. We go through stages as people, too, as bodies. You start out very quiet and very small, and then you learn to walk, and then you learn to talk, and then you get educated, and then you get smart, and then you start getting dumber. That's how humans progress through various stages. Well, Christians progress through various stages as well, but there are different kinds of stages, and they can throw you for a loop. I remember reading a meditation on a verse that many of you know from Isaiah 40. You shall mount up with wings as eagles. You shall run and not be weary. You shall walk and not faint. And the meditation on that verse was written by a man named John Claypool. Claypool is an interesting man. He started out as a Baptist minister, but he got a divorce, so then he became an Episcopal priest, which is our version of Anglican priest before the Revolution and all that. But when he was writing this meditation, he said, it seems like an odd sequence, because Isaiah says we soar like eagles, and then we run, and then we walk. You'd think he has it backwards. We should start by running, and then or start by walking, then learn to run, and then learn to soar. But he was actually writing that meditation in a hospital room. His six-year-old daughter was dying of leukemia. And in the meditation, he said, I know well what it is to soar. He was a famous speaker. He would go around to venues like this and speak, and he has soared. And then he said, I also know what it is to run. I've been running all over the country trying to find a cure for my daughter, to doctors, to healing evangelists, to people who will pray for her. And they all did, all the famous people you've heard of. But now it's pretty clear that she's dying. And my faith is at the place where it's really all I can do to stand and not faint. The stages of the Christian life took him by surprise, and I think they take a lot of people by surprise. I've been through the Bible, and I very roughly categorize them into three stages: the child stage, the adult stage, and the parent stage. The child stage, a lot of people get stuck in the child stage. If you want to know what it's like to be to have a childish type faith in God, I would recommend that you just spend all of your time in the Old Testament. It was a very childlike stage of faith. In fact, Paul, writing back on the Old Testament, said it was really like a schoolmaster, like a baby minder, a preparatory period to lead us to the freedom that we now have in Christ. And I go back and look at how life was in the Old Testament. I remember when I was writing the book Disappointment with Mold, Disappointment with God, I was studying the book of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, when the children of Israel were wandering in Egypt, or just got out of Egypt and were in the wilderness. At that time, the book says three questions no one asks aloud. The questions are, is God silent, is God hidden, and is God unfair? Those questions were posed to me by a man who had been a Christian author and then got so upset by those questions, he threw it all away. He took his Bible out, he took his book out, and just burned it in his backyard. His faith went up in smoke. Well, after he told me these questions, I was thinking, you know, those three questions never occurred to the Israelites in the desert, the Sinai desert. Is God silent? No, he was not silent. There was actually a room there called the Tent of Meeting. And if you wanted to know what God's will was, Moses would go inside this Tent of Meeting. It was covered with a cloud and smoke. And when he came out, he was actually glowing. They said, Moses, please put a veil over your face. We can't stand to look at you. But God was not silent. He would talk to them anything you wanted to know. God would tell you. Is God hidden? No, God was not hidden. There was a pillar of fire. There was a pillar of cloud. There was a mountain that was smoking. And if you woke up one day as a rebellious Jewish teenager and said, I don't believe in God anymore, there was a very easy cure for you. Your mother would say, well, sonny, just there's a room over there called the Most Holy Place, and just go inside there for a minute, and you will recover your faith in God for one nanosecond right before you're incinerated. Everybody knew there was God. He was present. You could see evidence of him, smoke and fire and They didn't have that question, is God hidden? Is God unfair? No. God actually had a signed contract. That's what the word covenant means. A contract saying, if you obey these rules, and he spells out the rules, here's what I'll do for you. I will make sure that that all of your cattle are fertile, that all of your crops grow, that you'll always have good weather, you'll never have a drought. I'll make sure that you have no diseases, no hoof and mouth diseases. You could bring all the dogs you want to Greenbelt. I'll make sure that you win all of your battles. You'll never lose a battle. This is a pretty good deal. You'll never get sick. That's what I'll do for you if you keep these commands. That's what the covenant means. However, if you break these commands, and some of the most horrifying passages ever written are in the very end of Deuteronomy, where God says, this is what will happen if you break my covenant. And those passages are actually a description of what has happened to the Jewish people over the years. All those prophecies have come true. But now we look back on that time, and especially Paul looks back on that time as not a time of great faith, but a time of great failure. We don't look back on the Sinai desert period as, oh man, would I like to recover that? We think, man, am I glad to get rid of that stuff. What do I learn? What kind of churches today are stuck in childish faith? A couple of characteristics. One characteristic I see is extreme legalism. My wife works in a Jewish nursing home. She's the Christian chaplain in a Jewish nursing home. I mean, I'm pretty impressed. I mean, like 13% of the people there are Christians, so the Jewish people hire a Christian chaplain to service those people. If Christians ran a nursing home and 13% of the people were Jewish, they try to convert them all. They wouldn't hire a Jewish rabbi, but the Jewish place hires a Christian chaplain, so I respect that. But one of the things she learned there is that legalism is not a bad word to Jews. To most Christians, if you say, you're a legalist, they say, I am not. But if you say to an Orthodox Jew, you're a legalist, you say, oh, well, thank you. This is a compliment. They almost compete to be more legalistic. In fact, there's a rule in the Old Testament, part of that covenant thing, where God says every year you should clean your kitchen. And one of the things you should do in cleaning your kitchen is take out all of your clay pots and pans and break them and start over with new pots and pans. It was very good for the people who make pots and pans. Well, we don't have clay pots and pans these days. They have a stainless steel kitchen, actually, in this place. But once a year on that Jewish holiday, they bring in an acetylene torch and torch the entire stainless steel kitchen, because that's what it says in Leviticus, kind of. you know, the modern English version of Leviticus. And if you go to Israel, for example, they've debated about what you can do and can't do on the Sabbath, because the Bible says don't do any work on the Sabbath. Well, one of the things they decided was work was pushing the elevator buttons. So in a good elevator, an Orthodox elevator in downtown Tel Aviv, on Saturday, every elevator stops on every floor. If you ever go to Israel as a tourist and you're staying over a Saturday, make sure you have a lower floor. Or otherwise, if you're on the 40th floor, it'll stop 40 times every time you go to your room. Because they're legalists. And legalism is a good thing to a Jewish person, because they really believe this is how we get God's approval, by keeping all these rules. Paul, who is a great legalist, who was raised that way, was so glad that he could ride the elevator all the way to the top without stopping. He was delighted to be free of that. And when he looked back on it, he thought, man, who wants that? Freedom in Christ. But a lot of people get stuck in that legalistic mold. Another carryover, characteristic of childish faith, and it's a stage that many people have to go through. I have gone through it. Many of you have gone through it. Some of you may still be there, so I want to be careful. But another stage that people go through is the expectation that if I behave, if I do good things, then God will reward me, and if I do bad things, then God will punish me. And you can certainly find verses, especially in the Old Testament, to support that. I mean, that's what the covenant's all about. If you obey, God will reward you. If you disobey, God will punish you. But of course, there are a lot of exceptions there. But people get stuck there. And when they get stuck there, some strange things happen. It's very attractive. In America, most television programs, religious television programs, are what we call the prosperity gospel. Why? Because if somebody's just tuning in, you want them to keep tuning in. More, you want them to give money. And if you tell them the truth, you know what? In a lot of ways, your life is going to be a lot harder if you follow Jesus, because you have to worry about the poor, you have to worry about the environment, you got to give away a lot of your money, you got to care about the poor, stuff like that. Who's going to watch that? So instead they say, if you just believe and send me $5, I'll send you a handkerchief and it'll heal you of all your diseases. And it sounds so great. And I've traveled around the world. I've been to countries that are right smack in the middle of that prosperity gospel. In some of those countries, Brazil, the Philippines, the church is growing like crazy. However, if you talk to the pastors, they say what you don't hear about is that the people walk straight out the back door. They're attracted because they think, if I just come forward and become a Christian, do what you say, then I'll always keep my job and I won't get sick. And, you know, I don't know about this, but I think, well, I'm pretty sure as I look out, that about the same number of Christians wear eyeglasses as non-Christians. About the same number of Christians grow bald as non-Christians. You guys are too young. You'll get there. I think, I could be wrong here, but I think about the same number of Christians proportion-wise get sick as non-Christians. And I'm sure of this, exactly the same percentage of Christians die. 100%. You don't get a free pass saying that you won't have any problems when you become a Christian. And I get a lot of mail from people who go to churches who are shocked when bad things happen to them. They're stuck in this childish view of faith. It's very attractive, but it's also rather dangerous. I remember once watching one of those television evangelists, Oral Roberts, and he looked right in the camera right at me. He said, "Something good is going to happen to you this week." And he's so impressive. I believed it. Later that week, I read in the newspaper that Oral Roberts' son committed suicide, shot himself that week. And I wondered, how did Oral Roberts feel after telling the entire world something good is going to happen to you when something awful and tragic happened to him? I could tell you story after story there, but I'm not trying to upset anybody's faith, but I'm trying to be realistic. I guarantee you that if you found your faith, if you become a Christian expecting that only good things will happen to you, I guarantee you, you will be disappointed. It's not bad for me because I write books for people like that and make a living on them, but I guarantee it's gonna happen. So very gently, we have to kind of move out of the childish stage of faith. When I read the New Testament, I see Paul relaxing, almost sighing with relief. You can read when he writes to childish churches like in Galatians and Corinthians, he's lecturing them. He's like a schoolmarm, you know. Oh, man, you should be eating a diet of meat and you're still not unable to digest anything but milk. I'm so tired of dealing with you guys. Grow up, he wants to say. And when he's dealing with children, he lectures like a parent. When people are stealing, he doesn't say, well, now, let's discuss this reasonably. Kleptomania is a weakness. It's a psychological weakness. And I recommend, why don't you try to limit your theft to Wednesdays and Saturdays? Let's start there. He doesn't do that. He says, those of you who are stealing, stop stealing. Steal no more. When he's dealing with people who are stuck in the childish stage, he treats them like children. But when he gets to adults, the church in Ephesus, the church in Philippians, Colossians, he just relaxes. Every one of those books, he starts out with painting a picture of how wonderful God's grace is, what he has done for us. Often in a prayer that goes on and on with sentences that are very difficult to diagram. And he says, in view of all that God has done for you, don't you want to live worthy of that calling? That's his appeal. In fact, you can do study. I have a friend who had got his PhD studying motivation, and he found out that people, there are two kinds of motivations, avoidance motivation and approach motivation. Avoidance motivation would be, I do not want to flunk this course. I don't want to get an F in this course. That's avoidance. Approach motivation is, I would like to get an A in this course. I'd like to get a first in this course. And what he found is that people who have that positive motivation are more likely to meet their goal. And even if they don't meet their goal, they're happier, they have better health. They have more well-being. It's just a more adult way of approaching life. And Paul is so thrilled. I had a great illustration of what adult motivation can be like. Once I heard Mahatma Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, speak. He told a story of growing up in South Africa. Mahatma Gandhi lived for a time in South Africa and raised a family there. And then his own son grew up in South Africa, became a great civil rights lawyer there. Well, this is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, the son of the great civil rights lawyer. When he was 16 years old, he got his driver's license. And one day his father came to him and said, Arun, would you be willing to drive me into Cape Town today? Well, this is, you know, to ask a 16-year-old, would you like to drive? Of course. And to drive into the big city, great. So he said, drop me off, and then I need you to take the car to this garage, and I need you to pick it up promptly and meet me at this corner by 6 o'clock. So, okay. So he drops his father off. He goes, drops the car off, and then he goes down to see a movie. It was an American Western cowboy Indian type movie. It was a hot day outside, but the theater was air conditioned, and he found that if he just sat in his seat, he could see a second movie free. So he did. He stayed in his seat, and what a great day. He got to drive, he got to see two movies. He walked outside, and the sun was already setting. He thought, oh no, the garage is going to be closed. So he sprinted over to the garage. Fortunately, they were not closed, they were open. They gave him the car, and so he drove to pick up his father. Well, he's well late by now. It's at least 6:30, 7 o'clock, and he picks up his father, who's standing on the corner, and he says, oh, Dad, so whew, I'm sorry. You know, they ran into some problems with the car, and they just couldn't get it fixed. I had to send for parts, and I had to wait for it, but whew, fortunately, they got it done. His father didn't say a word until they drove to the edge of town. And then he said, son, could you pull over? And he pulled over, and he said, Arun, I know that you lied to me because I called the garage at 5:30 and the car was done there. And I'm thinking now how I have failed you as a father that you would feel it necessary to lie to me. Why couldn't you trust me with the truth? I must have failed you. In fact, I'm going to get out of the car and I would like to walk home and meditate on this. And I'd like you to drive behind me because I need your headlights. It's a dirt road by now. So here's a 16-year-old boy going, I mean, how fast do people go? 4 miles an hour in a car behind his father, who's walking with his head down, meditating for 6 hours. Well, when Arun Gandhi told me that story, I said, man, what a guilt trip your old man put on you. He said, no. You don't know my father. My father is a great man. My father had integrity. My father is a leader. My father changed our nation. My father wasn't putting a guilt trip on me. He indeed thought he had failed me. And that changed me forever, that experience. In fact, he said, since that day when I was 16 years old, I have never once told a lie. That's adult motivation. And that's the kind of motivation that Paul uses when he talks to the early Christians. He says, let me tell you what God is like. In view of that, in view of God's love, in view of all that God has done for you, wouldn't you like to live worthy of your calling? He's not up there shaking his finger, I'm going to spank you if you may. That's childish behavior. Rather, let me show you the grace that God has done for you. Can you see it in yourself to forgive your neighbor? So many of Jesus' parables emphasize that very same theme. That's not the final stage of faith, though. There's the child stage, there's the adult stage, and then there's what I call the parent stage. Now, I'm not a parent. I've been married a very long time, 31 years, but there are some things we haven't figured out yet, and having children is one of them. I heard the other day, do you know why it takes 100 million sperm to create one human being? Because none of them will stop and ask for directions. But anyway, the parent stage, I don't know how parents do it. Now, I know some of you are parents, and I can barely get through my to-do list. I can't imagine living with these little creators of chaos running around all the time. But they do it, and the people who come skiing in the winter usually come back in the summer and bring their entire families with them. And I've watched these parents in action. I'm trying to figure out, why would anybody do this to themselves? Because especially the parents of teenagers, you know, they save thousands of dollars. They're going to go on a vacation of the lifetime. They're taking their kids to a beautiful Colorado. So they pack the family car, drive all the way across the country, and they get to Colorado. And they say, okay, where are the beautiful parts? Well, let's show you. So we take them. And here are these kids. They're sitting in the back. They're either playing with their Game Boys or their text messaging email or some computer gizmo. And we say, look, there's the tallest mountain in the United States. Yeah, I know. I've seen mountains. No, you haven't. You've seen them on TV. This is a real mountain. Look, there's a waterfall. Yeah, it's not as big as Niagara. That's a real waterfall. And the only way we can even get these kids' attention is to take them whitewater rafting. That'll do it usually, because if you don't pay attention there, you're dead. So the water, you know, it was snow yesterday. It hit you right in the face. So, but at the end, every time at the end of this vacation, they all hug us and say, even the parents, after being abused like this, they hug us and say, oh, that was the greatest vacation we ever had. I thought, man, what is your normal life like? Why? I have never once heard a teenager say, Mother, Father, I would just like to express my appreciation for the many sacrifices. I can't imagine the planning that went into this trip, and I've had such a fulfilling, meaningful experience. My wife used to work with the very poor people in Chicago, and she would get discouraged because they keep coming back and asking for more, and nobody ever said thank you. And then one day, somebody gave her a little sign she put on her desk. It made her feel oddly comforted. It said, the poor say thank you by coming back and asking again. And she realized that's true. It's a very hard thing to be needy, to have to ask for help, for charity. And the fact that they trust her enough to come back and ask again was really their way of saying thank you. And I think every parent should have a sign on their desk that says, children say thank you by abusing you once more. That's what being a parent is all about. But why do we do it? Well, you tell me. You do it. I didn't. But why do we do it? Well, there's something about, there's a stage you reach in when you realize that life is about more than just fulfilling your own needs. You want to give. You want to create. You want to nourish. You want to raise. You don't have to be a physical parent, a biological parent, to do that. In fact, an important stage of the spiritual life is when you realize this life is not just about me feeling good. It's about giving myself away. In this book, Soul Survivor, my publisher has been patiently waiting for me to mention it. In this book, Soul Survivor, I tell how I really came back to faith after running away from toxic churches, very bad churches. I came back to faith not because of pastors, not because of churches, not because of Billy Graham, but because as a journalist, the people that I interviewed who were not professional Christians, the ones who impressed me most were not the celebrities, the people we put on the covers of our magazines that we want to know every little detail of their lives. As I got to know those people, I really didn't want to be like them. I found underneath they were pretty miserable, actually. The people who really did impress me were people who had reached the parent stage of the spiritual journey, people who gave themselves away. They didn't even stop with the adult stage. They went beyond, like a Jackie Pullinger, like I'll mention some of the people I talk about who changed my whole way of looking at life. One is Dr. Paul Brand. He's a British citizen and an orthopedic surgeon. One of the most brilliant people I've ever spent time with. I spent 10 years with him writing books. And Dr. Brand could have had his own laboratory at Oxford or Cambridge, could have maybe won the Nobel Prize. He's won every prize in medicine you can get. But instead, he gave all that up. And he spent his life among the lowest people on the entire planet. And those are people of the untouchable caste in India who have leprosy. You can't get any lower than that. They're already at the very bottom of the social ladder, and then they get a feared disease and are kicked out of their families and their villages. And no one will pay them the time of day except this brilliant orthopedic surgeon who would painstakingly recreate their hands. I've seen leprosy patients he's worked on where he's done 27 surgeries on their hands so that finally they'll move like this instead of being stuck in a claw. As I've gotten to know people like Dr. Brand, I started out by pitying him because the places where they put leprosaria, they're not the nice suburbs. They're deserts. They're out in the middle of nowhere. Nobody wants to live next to one. And in those places, working in very hostile conditions, Dr. Brand became one of the richest, largest, fullest human beings I have ever met. The contrast between somebody like him and these celebrities that we put on our covers of magazines could not be greater. Or I think of people like Robert Coles. He's a chapter in my book, and you may not know him. In America, most people would. He's a psychiatrist at Harvard University. He was on the cover of Time magazine, and Time called him the most influential living psychiatrist in the world. He was a professor at Harvard, and in the days of the civil rights movement, he was assigned to go to places in the South where they were integrating the schools. He chose to go to New Orleans, Louisiana, and he focused on this one little girl named Ruby, 6 years old, black girl. She was the only student going to school because they were boycotting the entire school because they didn't want black children at their school. And every day, she would walk like a gauntlet, a mob of white people screaming at her, yeah, calling her names, calling her vile racial slurs every day. And she would be completely surrounded by federal marshals carrying automatic weapons and shotguns and pistols, keeping the screaming white people from killing her. And then she would go to school. It would have a full staff of a principal and teachers, but only one student, Ruby. Dr. Coles assigned, watched her at first, and he noticed that she was talking to herself and said, well, that's obviously psychopathological behavior, so I need to interview her. So he did. He said, Ruby, I noticed that you've been talking to yourself when you walk to school. Yes, sir. Could I ask what you're saying? Well, sir, I'm praying. Aha, well, I can understand that. You're praying for courage. You're praying for safety. No, sir, that's not what I'm praying for. Well, what is it you are praying for? Well, I'm praying for those white people because they're so mad at me, and Jesus said, love your enemies. So I'm praying that I would feel love toward them. And then Dr. Coles, the Harvard psychiatrist, sent down to deal with the psychopathology of little Ruby Bridges, instead found himself literally on his knees at her eye level saying, teach me about that kind of love. I've never learned that kind of love from Harvard, from the places I hang out. And eventually, beautifully, Dr. Coles came back to faith, not because he was argued into it by any impressive intellects, but because he hung around people like Ruby Bridges, who told him that, as Jesus said, unless you come like a little child into my kingdom, you will in no wise enter the kingdom of God. Or I think of one last person, Henry Nouwen. Henry Nouwen also had a great resume. He too taught at Harvard, taught at Yale, taught at Notre Dame. But to everyone's surprise, the last 10 years of his life, he left all of those positions and instead moved into a home for the mentally retarded, the profoundly retarded in Toronto. I visited him there, and I watched his daily routine. His daily routine was taking care of a man named Adam. Adam was 20-some years old, but he had the mind of, I don't know, a two-year-old. He certainly couldn't talk, probably couldn't recognize Henry Nouwen, and yet here was this brilliant academic psychologist priest spending about 2.5 hours every day dressing Adam, bathing him. I guess he bathed him first and then dressed him. feeding him, just kind of getting him through the day. And after watching this, I screwed up my courage and said, Dr. Nouwen, do you ever wonder, is this the best use of my time? Oh, bad question. He pounced on me, and he kept coming back to that question all day long. Like, how could you ask such a thing? No, that's never occurred to me. I've never done anything more worthwhile. In fact, he says, the desert monastics in the 3rd century would spend an entire lifetime in the desert trying to achieve what Adam is teaching me, what unconditional love is, what helpless dependence is, what emptying oneself is. I learned that from Adam. And at the end of the day, I kind of walked out of there like a dog with its tail between its legs, saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to ask that question. Oh, I'll tell you one last story. One of my favorite characters named Millard Fuller. Millard Fuller was a classic American entrepreneur. He was practically a millionaire by the time he got out of high school because he had this scam going. He would pay the secretary for the principal of the school to give him everyone's name, phone number, and birthday. And then he would call the mothers of little Mary. He'd call little Mary's mother and say, Mrs. Jones, he is in Alabama, Ms. Jones, I understand little Mary's having a birthday next Wednesday. Is that right? Well, yes, sir, that's right. Well, we have a little tradition around our school. For $5, we'll bake her cake and we'll have the whole school lunchroom sing happy birthday to her. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, yes, that would be very nice. I mean, what mother's going to say no? So he was practically a millionaire by the time he got out of high school. And then he's in rural Alabama. He noticed that all the tractors back then in the early 1950s were made out of metal, these metal seats, and these farmers are bouncing up and down. He thought, man, that's got to be uncomfortable. So he got a friend of his to invent a tractor-shaped cushion, and he made another $1 million. Everything he touched turned to gold, except his own life. And he found himself, his wife ran away from him, went to New York, and he went to New York to recover his wife, try to put his marriage back together. He met an African-American taxi driver, and kind of the taxi driver kind of overheard them talking in the back seat, and he said, you know what you need, sir? You need to go down to Georgia and see Clarence Jordan. And so he did. Now, Clarence Jordan was one of the great radical Christians in the early 1960s. He wrote the Cotton Patch Gospel. I don't know if you've seen that over here. It was a Broadway play, and then he actually loosely translated the New Testament. He ran a farm. We called them all communists. They lived together, all kind of races, and they shared their money. You know, they did all that crazy stuff that Jesus told us to do. And they actually did it. And every week they would get bombed and shot up by the Ku Klux Klan. They raised pecans to finance their ministry, the Koinonia Farms. And on every bag of pecans, they slapped a label that said, help us ship the nuts out of Georgia. And so that's where Millard Fuller went. Clarence listened to his story and said, well, man, I know what your problem is. You got entirely too much money. You got to give away all your money. And Millard said, you mean all of it? Well, isn't that what Jesus said to the rich young ruler? Well, I reckon so. Well, then get going. So he did. Here's this millionaire. He went and gave away all of his money. Then he came back and he said, well, I did give away my money. All of it? Yes, sir. Well, we got to find a job for you now, don't we? And Clarence said, let's sit here. Let's think for a minute. What do you think makes God really unhappy? And they started talking. Well, people who get sick, poor people, blah, blah. And they made a list. And the one they decided on was, don't you think it makes God unhappy that there are people in this world who don't have any place to live, who sleep under bridges, who sleep on cardboard boxes. In the winter, they sleep on heating grates in cities. Yeah, I think that makes God very unhappy. Well, why don't you go out and build a house for every one of those people? Every one of them? Well, do you think God will be happy if there was one person out there? I guess not. Well, then you better get going. And so he did, and that was about 20 years ago, and Millard Fuller has not yet built a house for everyone who doesn't have a house, but he did found Habitat for Humanity, and they're now working on their 200,000th house built just because he took the message of Jesus seriously. I was in a radio studio right after Millard was there in Chicago, and this Jewish woman called up very angry at him and said, Mr. Fuller, what is all this Jesus stuff? I gave you money here. I'm trying to help people who don't have homeless. I get all these mailings and it's all this Jesus stuff. I'm Jewish. I don't want to evangelize the world with this Jesus stuff. And Millard said, ma'am, you don't have to be a Christian to live in one of our houses, and you don't have to be a Christian to help build one of our houses, but I got to tell you, the reason I do what I do, the reason most of the volunteers do what they do, is because they believe Jesus wants them to. That's why my organization exists. It's through people like that that I learned what it means, the parent stage of faith, that Jesus was right in his most repeated statement, which was, you don't gain your life by grabbing it, by seizing it, by getting more and more, you really gain your life by losing it, by giving it away to others in that parent stage of faith. I don't know where you are. There are some of you probably from churches that are stuck in the child stage of faith. And hey, I've been there. Probably all of us have been there. It's kind of nice. And I don't know if this is heresy or not, but I've got this theory that actually, that if you're a young Christian, God is more likely to answer your prayers. I think God is nicer to young Christians, actually. It's those who've been around a while who really have tough assignments. You know, a lot of us feel like we're on our own sometimes. Some of you are in the childish stage of faith. Hey, enjoy it. There will come a time probably when your life doesn't work out like you expected it to, and then you can buy one of my books, because I write about that all the time. There are some of you who are in the adult stage of faith that are so free, so glad to be free of that cloying legalism, that prosperity gospel. You're so glad, you just look down on everybody else, and that makes you a child again, so it's kind of a cycle you get into. But then there are some of you who really know what that parent stage is like. Some of you who go on short-term mission projects. Some of you who are attracted to the Tear Fund booths and some of the other booths around here. And I would encourage you to keep marching down that path, because we all go through stages, and it's not necessarily the kind of stages that you expect when you sign up for it. But I am convinced, after spending a lot of time talking to a lot of Christians, that Jesus was right, and that those further stages are the real rewarding stages. If you get stuck in the child, there's nothing sadder than a permanent child, than a 50-year-old person who acts like a 3-year-old person. There's nothing sadder. And in some ways, there's nothing. It's also sad to be a selfish adult, but someone in that parent stage who realizes the purpose of life, the purpose of wealth, the purpose of power, the purpose of all the good things that God gave us is to give them away, to share them, to invest them in others, as Jesus' parable says. That's the final stage and the most rewarding stage at all. Well, I've gotten very strict instructions that I need to leave 15 minutes for questions. So we are now entering the question phase, and they didn't give me any instructions about questions, so I'm not giving you any restrictions whatsoever. You can ask me about anything. I know a lot about mold, for example, so I'm happy to talk about the intricacies of fungus. And any other question you want to ask until 8:15, I'll be glad to entertain. I think there is a roving microphone somewhere. Is that right? You've got one? Okay. Maybe if you just kind of start on one side and gradually walk across, and I'm supposed to repeat the questions because I guess there is a tape going on. Okay. If you get to people, then it goes to the tape automatically. Is that right? Okay, great. Thank you, Greenbell, for my champagne. Isn't that nice? Very nice. Why don't we start over here? Are there any questions from this side? Okay, how about the middle? No? Okay, well, no. There's one right there. Do I go to church, she asks. Yes, I do go to church. Every week that it's possible for me, I do. Yeah. And I wrote a book called Church, Why Bother? That really addresses that issue. The subtitle of this book, it says, Soul Survivor, How My Faith Survived the Church. I was speaking couple days ago in Coventry, and they had big posters that said, Philip Yancey will speak on Soul Survivor, How My Faith Survived the Church at Methodist Central Hall. So, and I survived that one too. I made it out of Coventry, so. Good question, though. Yes. Why do I go to church? Well, part of it is a spiritual, I happen to go to a pretty good church, so it's not a painful experience, but part of it's a spiritual discipline, and there aren't that many places, frankly, where I'm around a diversity of people. Babies who cry, old people who can't hear what's being said. You know, that church is one of the few places where I'm around people who are really different than I am. And in addition, I truly believe there's a quote that I use in that book from one of the great church early church fathers who says, a coal taken away from the fire loses its heat. Yeah, yeah. And I need church because Being a Christian is not a freelance occupation. Oh, well, thank you. The church needs me, she says. Okay. Okay, we've got one down this side. Anybody with a microphone, or do you have a loud voice? She has a loud voice. I don't see her. Do you have a body? Oh, good. Whoa, is that deep or what? I will repeat the question. Yes, she said, what color are your eyes? And that, no, she said, if the old covenant is a childish faith, then why did God bother with it in the first place? Why didn't he just do the incarnation? You know, that depends on whether you're a Presbyterian or a Baptist. No. Okay, this may sound a little heretical, but I think there are two parties who needed to learn some things, in quotes, okay? One party that needed to learn some things were human beings. And in fact, Paul was very explicit. He said, the old covenant is like a paedagogus. It's like a minder. It's like a babysitter to lead you to Christ. And the whole purpose, he said, was not to demonstrate this is how you get God to like you, but to demonstrate that if God acted in the ways that you think he should, it doesn't work. And it took, okay, God is on a different timetable than we are. It took him maybe 6,000 years to make that point. And we think maybe he should have done it a lot faster. But frankly, the fact that we've got the whole Old Testament, like my friend, he says, if God would just answer those three questions, then all our problems would be solved. I could say, no, look, God did. Maybe the reason God acts the way he does, which is baffling and mysterious to me, is because he knows something I don't know. In fact, he gave us a record of that in the Old Testament. We human beings needed to learn something. And then there's another part, and I got to be very careful how I word this, but I think that the story of the Old Testament is God, quote, learning how to be a parent. God created free human beings, and there are a lot of verses in the Bible where God says, they did things that hadn't even entered into my mind, speaking of infant sacrifice. And God says that in Jeremiah, Ezekiel. And I think that the whole relationship going on back and forth between God and human beings was a two-way relationship. And both were being affected by it. That continued on through the incarnation because it says Jesus learned obedience through the things that he suffered, learned. You know, I'm sorry this is on tape because that's probably heretical and would be hard to explain to a real theologian, but when I read the Old Testament, that's what stands out to me. So, yes, in the middle.
Can you be in the parent stage of faith and pursuing a career?
Can you be in the parent stage of faith and pursuing a career? No, you have to quit your job. No. Well, sure you can. Sure you can. Take the people in this book. These are people who shaped my faith profoundly. As I look at them, there's really only one, quote, professional Christian, and that's Henry Nouwen, who's a priest. One is a psychiatrist. One is a surgeon. One was a journalist. I guess Martin Luther King Jr. was a pastor. I don't know what you call Mahatma Gandhi, professional agitator, I guess. Another surgeon, a couple of writers. Sure, the question isn't, are we all called to be like Jackie Pullinger's? Obviously not. And I struggle with this in my own marriage. I told you how my wife used to, and still does, do social work type, very direct ministry, hands-on, dealing with people type occupations, and I don't. I sit in a room and move electrons around on a screen, and it's very frustrating. I wrote an article one time about our dinner conversation. She would come home, and I would say, how was your day? She would say, oh, man, we found this family living under a bridge. They'd been sleeping in a car. They hadn't eaten in 3 days, so I called social services, and I got them some food, and I did this and that, and, you know, 15 minutes later, and then she'll say, how was your day? And I said, I know. At 2 o'clock, I found a very good adverb. And That was the most exciting thing that happened to me all day, you know? But, you know, I face that too. My career. So my question is, what do I do with my career? Our pastor in Chicago in the issue of money said there are really three questions about money, and this I think applies directly to your question. How did you get it? Did you get it through illegal means or whatever? What are you going to do with it? What do you do with it? Are you just spending it on yourself, competing, having bigger cars, etc.? But the third and most important question is, what is it doing to you? And I think you can actually take those same principles and apply them to maybe what's behind your question, and that is, what do you do with the calling, with the career, with the resources, with the gifts that God has given to you? We're not all called and not all capable of being Jackie Pullingers or Dr. Paul Brands, but we are all given gifts, and we're asked to use them in service to others. And sometimes people do it through ways like the people in this book, and sometimes people do it on the streets of Hong Kong dealing with drug addicts. Yes, over here. Yes. Yes, would I like to say a little bit about moving from one stage to another, child, adult, and parent? What a nice way to phrase a question. Would I like to say something? No. Next question. No, no, that's very good. I think actually one of the great functions that the body of Christ can serve is gently, carefully moving people along, because actually, when I have written about this, I've written, there's a difference between childish faith and childlike faith. You see, it's easy to confuse those two. Jesus told us to pray like children, coming to our Father, Daddy, can I? So what happens when those prayers don't get answered, you know? Do you keep praying them? What is the difference between childlike and childish faith? That takes discernment. It takes teaching. It takes wisdom and knowledge. It takes a teacher or pastor, somebody who can lead you. One of the healthiest signs I see in the church right now is this emphasis on short-term missions. I don't think they do that much for Haiti or Africa or wherever you guys go, but I think they do a lot for the people who go there because they come back changed. I mean, maybe they help build a church or something, and that's great. But I think the main emphasis, the main value of that is, like the missionary martyr Jim Elliott said he realized that the most important thing God cared about was not the work that he was doing through him, but the work that he's doing in him. And I think God does care about that. So I think the church, I mean, the church speaking broadly, including Greenbelt, can help all of us by carefully, cautiously taking these new baby Christians, brand new in the faith, so excited, so exuberant, but you know they're going to fall flat. You don't trip them up. But you want to be there by them to help pick them up and explain, if God loves me, how can I get in an automobile accident? That question's bound to occur to them. And then to gradually move them from some of those problem areas to being an adult, which is full of problems, and then moving beyond that to the parent stage. I think that's one of the chief functions of the gifts of the body of Christ. It's a great reminder. Thank you. Right here.
I'm wondering how does a fundamentalist legalist, who's maybe you could say is in a child phase, how do you see someone like that develop into the, thinking almost, I've got a brother and sister who live in America, very much in the kind of right wing American, fundamentalist, whatever. How do you actually try and expand their horizons to try and allow grace to start to bring in?
Oh, that's a great question, and I guess we have to close on this question, which is wonderful. He said, how do you help a fundamentalist, very narrow, kind of black and white thinking person to move beyond that when they're sure they're right, and his happens to be in America, probably beyond hope, you can't help them, but someone who you're just kind of sure is wrong and stuck. But how do you help crack open those walls? Well, that's the story of my whole life. Frankly, I think words are among the very best ways of doing that. I think I became a writer because the effect of other writers on me. Because When I had never met an intelligent Christian before, okay, when I was in college, including my professors. It was a Bible college. And I started reading books by C.S. Lewis, by G.K. Chesterton, and I said, wow, you actually can think and be rational and be a Christian. I'd never met one before. But books helped me to do that. And I tell the story in this book of how a right-wing, narrow-minded, fundamentalist person changes into the kind of person they invite to Greenbelt, for better or worse. It was primarily through finding my world shattered. For instance, I was taught in the church I grew up in a straight racist kind of apartheid theology that white people are superior, people of color are inferior, God cursed them, he made them to be servants, they're very good at jobs like being a waiter and waitresses, but they could never be president of a company, for example. I mean, my pastor taught me that. I'm a kid, I'm growing up, I believe that, everybody believes it, that I know. I report for my very first job. It's a summer fellowship at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. And my supervisor I know is a PhD in biochemistry. His name is Dr. Cherry. And I walk in. Dr. Cherry is a black man. and the cracks start falling. And I realize my church lied to me all these years. My church betrayed me. And I hear from a lot of people who have different but similar experiences where their world doesn't match what they hear in that kind of narrow cloister. And your relative, you know, you can't, if you come in and say, look, you're wrong, immediately, well, he's one of them. Of course, it's like if you're paranoid and you came, if I'm paranoid and you came to me and said, really, I'm your friend. Well, of course you're going to say that. You're my enemy, but you're trying to be my friend, you know. There's no way you can convince him. But words are a helpful way to do that. Travel is another way, and prayer, and just being a loving, faithful liberal to him, you know, which he'll think is an oxymoron, but you can prove it otherwise. Well, we're out of time, and boy, it's hot in here, and you guys have been very patient, and somebody's making a lot of noise around here, but thanks very much. I enjoyed it, and hope to see some of you tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Philip. Philip's back here tomorrow at 11:15, same seminar tent, tomorrow morning, 11:15. You better start queuing at 8 o'clock in the morning, I think.